Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Check your pay stub. At least 21 states are going to raise the minimum wage this year. There's hope the housing market will be better in 2015. All that and a little hair of the dog. Happy New Year from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday, January 1st, 2015, and it's good to have you with us. 2014 was not a great year for the housing market. It was in a kind of holding pattern. Prices went up, but not by much, and there wasn't much of an uptick in sales either. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the outlook for this year.
Most housing market watchers do expect 2015 to be better than 2014. How much better? Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He told me he expects home sales to go up about 10% this year.
That's a realistic expectation. Frankly, if we just continued what we saw in the second half of 2014, we'd be up 10%.
As long as interest rates don't shoot up too much and unemployment doesn't get any worse, how about prices? What will happen to them in 2015? I asked Stephanie Carroll about that. She's a U.S. economist with IHS Global Insight.
We are predicting that the price of the average existing single-family home will come in around 2.8% year-on-year for 2015.
In other words, prices will increase around 2.8% this year, compared to more than 3% in 2014. So it's all sweetness and light for the housing market this year, right? Not so fast. There's a housing Grinch looming in the background.
Just put a green face on me.
Anthony Sanders teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. He says there's a big shadow looming over the 2015 housing market. Wages, they're only increasing by around 2%. Sanders says we need 5 or 6% wage growth for people to have enough money to buy a house. He says the jobs being created in this economic recovery don't pay that well.
Most service industry, you know, wait staff, and those are not people that are traditional homeowners.
Sanders says until wages pick up, we'll have to rely on foreign investors who still see U.S. housing as a bargain. Sanders doesn't think we'll get back toward a normal housing market until 2016 or 17. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
New Year's Day is traditionally a time to focus on the future, but that can be tough if you stayed up too late or if your New Year's Eve was, I don't know, a little too festive. What help is at hand? Marketplace's Stan Alcorn reports.
Let's say, hypothetically, last night you had one too many glasses of champagne or shots of tequila. And today, your head, your stomach, your eyes, everything hurts. Dr. Robert Swift can give you a diagnosis.
You have a hangover.
But why?
Well, you know, we really don't know.
We know it's the alcohol, but Swift says it could be the way it's inflaming your stomach, the chemicals it's releasing in your liver, the way it dehydrates you by tweaking your pituitary gland, or just a form of alcohol withdrawal, the low that follows the high.
I think it's the totality of these things, and that's why there's no single cure for hangovers.
And yet mankind and the pharmaceutical industry have always dreamed. Dr. Edzard Ernst has evaluated a number of attempted hangover cures.
We've done a clinical trial, actually, of a supplement made out of artichokes.
Yes, artichokes.
The trial was great fun because we had to drink a lot, but the result was squarely negative.
Results were just as disappointing for prickly pear and yeast. But the latest trend is selling IVs that deliver hydration and vitamins straight to the bloodstream, like the $219 detox prescribed by the IV doc, Adam Nadelson.
A liter of fluid, maybe even up to 2 liters of fluid if you're having vomiting.
Dr. Swift says that could make sense if you had something like cholera. But for the rest of us, Gatorade and a couple of aspirin is really the best we can do. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. Wall Street was closed today because of New Year's, but don't worry, the numbers don't go on vacation. McDonald's has fallen on some hard times. This past year, Mickey D's reported some of its worst earnings in 10 years. Fast food or quick service restaurants, that's their official name, have been struggling, as fast casual restaurants, places like Chipotle and Panera, have seen sales surge. So McDonald's is trying a few new tricks. This month, the company opened a test kitchen restaurant in Sydney called The Corner, selling fancier fare, not the usual burgers and fries. Last month, here in the U.S., McDonald's rolled out custom burger stations in a few cities. Stephen Jackson has the story.
Hello, welcome to McDonald's. How are you doing today?
I'm at a McDonald's in Laguna Niguel, California. It's one of the first McDonald's to feature Create Your Taste, a system for custom burgers. I know what you're thinking. Isn't that already a thing? I mean, Burger King started Have It Your Way back in the 70s.
Hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us serve it your way.
Trust me, this is different.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good.
I'm Brenda. I'll be your guide in helping you out to build your burger and create your own taste.
Brenda leads me to a kiosk with a touchscreen menu. First, I choose the patty.
And if you want to make it a double, you hit the plus button and then you hit the arrow and you keep going.
There's the standard fixings, but there's also fancy stuff.
We have 12 different toppings. We have three new ones, which is our grilled tomato. We have our crispy onions and cucumbers that we can add onto your burger.
I'm having my quarter pounder on an artisan roll with shaved Parmesan cheese, grilled mushrooms, bacon, lettuce, and garlic aioli. It costs about $7.
It takes 5 to 6 minutes to make the burger, and then there you are.
Brenda will bring it to my table when it's ready.
Millennials love anything that's electronic.
That's Bob Nabil. He's the owner and operator of this location. He says Create Your Taste is especially popular with young customers.
They would much rather interact through iPhones and iPads and computers than human.
Only 5 restaurants in the country have the kiosks now, but McDonald's plans to put them in 2,000 locations by the end of 2015.
Right now, customization is the key word. So it's our way of looking at our customers and saying, this is what you're asking for. We're going to try and give you exactly what you want.
Nabil says McDonald's hasn't always been great about listening to customers, but that's changing because the company isn't doing so hot, and they're not alone. Bonnie Riggs, a restaurant analyst with the NPD Group, says fast food is in a slump.
I've been studying the industry for over 30 years, and I've never seen prolonged weakness like this for the industry.
Why? Because there's a new game in town. Fast casual restaurants like Chipotle and Five Guys. They're pricier than most fast food, and they take longer, but
they're hitting all the right buttons, they're new, they're innovative, they're more creative.
And most importantly, they're all about customization. Hence, Create Your Taste, McDonald's foray into fast casual. Dan and Sophia Rawich are trying it for the first time.
I ordered a chicken patty with bacon, fried onions, and cheese on a ciabatta bread.
They have their tablets and smartphones out on the table while they wait for their food.
It was super easy, and I think it's easier to, not tell somebody what I want.
But it may not be easy enough. Most customers just want to get food and get out, hopefully without even leaving their car. And that's a problem, says owner Bob Nabil.
The order process in Create Your Taste is too intricate and too demanding to be able to do it in drive-thru. It would take you way too long to order.
So Nabil wants to adapt Create Your Taste for customers on the run, maybe with a mobile ordering app and a special parking lot. But for now, it's touchscreens and table service.
Here you go.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stephen Jackson for Marketplace.
Zambia is a landlocked country in southern Africa, just east of Angola. It's a place with a rich cultural heritage. Zambia is home to more than 70 different tribes, each of which has its own kind of music, a unique set of songs and beats. That musical heritage is threatened, however, by Zambia's economy and by the proliferation of music from the Western world. But some musicians are trying to keep it going. The BBC's Sarah Stellarts introduces us to a few of them.
These were the heady days of the Zambian music scene in the 1970s, when artists like Paul Ngozi, Ricky Lilonga, and this band, The Witch, created a genre that came to be known as Zamrock, an intoxicating sound clash of psychedelic guitars from the West with an African lilt. Emmanuel Jaggery Chanda sang lead vocals with The Witch, an acronym for We Intend to Cause Havoc. He explains how he got his middle name.
So we used to play a lot of Rolling Stones songs. So they were calling me Jagger. And I didn't like that idea of being in somebody's shadows. So I put a Y to it. It became Jaggery.
Sadly, this sweet period of music, born out of the seeds of independence and occurring at a time of great social unrest for Zambia, was not to last. Jaggery Chanda says events of the time effectively stopped a formal music industry from developing in his country.
Zambia was involved in political liberation struggles. So we experienced curfew and blackout that affected our performances. We couldn't perform at night, so we just stuck to afternoon shows, and it didn't augur well those days because people want to drink and enjoy themselves as they listen to music. We sort of left a gap, a big gap. The younger generation came aboard, but we didn't pass on the musical baton, if you like, in the proper way. There was little, no footages, no music to refer to. Vinyl records died out, no playback machines and things like that. So they had to start from the scratch.
By the late 1970s, the initial economic boom that marked Zambia's first years of independence turned into economic despair, as the copper prices upon which the country so heavily relied slumped. The country's only two record labels shut down, and when HIV/AIDS took hold of the country in the early 80s, it wiped out whole generations of musical talent. Jaggery Chanda is one of the few living musicians from the Zamrock movement.
This scourge has actually robbed Zambia of good musicians, great good musicians.
And of course, Zambia's musical heritage extends far beyond the 1970s. That is Maureen Lupo-Lisander, or Auntie Maureen, as she's affectionately referred to in Zambia. She's probably the country's best-known musician, and although she started out as a cabaret singer doing cover versions of well-known hits, she found her calling in going back to her Zambian roots.
Well, it's very diverse. You can't give one typical example. I mean, we have 73 ethnic groups, and each one comes with a unique rhythm and a melody, so it's very hard to describe Zambian music per se, but I like to describe it in general as an unpolished gem that's waiting to be discovered, polished and exposed.
In Lusaka, Zambia, I'm Sarah Stollarts for Marketplace.
Coming up,
what Wisely provides is personalized recommendations based on how you spend, like Netflix, but for the real world.
The creators of a new app want to improve the quality of online reviews. But first, let's do the numbers. The major markets were closed today for the New Year holiday, so now the numbers more broadly construed. 308,500. That's how many U.S. workers filed jobless claims each week in 2014. That's the lowest figure since the year 2000, according to the Labor Department. 30.239 million, that is how much oil in barrels members of the OPEC cartel have produced over the past month. The cartel's refusing to cut output despite falling oil prices. Here's a good one, 75 million, that's the number of people who have seen the 22 productions worldwide of The Lion King, the musical. It now has the highest global gross earnings of any movie or entertainment title in box office history. And 51 billion, that's the dollar cost of the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, the most expensive Olympic Games ever staged. And speaking of Russia, its currency, the ruble, has tanked as falling oil prices and economic sanctions took their toll. Over the past year, the ruble lost 46% against the dollar. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. It's a brand new year, and you're probably just getting over your hangover. Need a little motivation? If you're thinking you're the only one that has to go back to work, you're not. The markets will too be back on their normal schedule, making it the first trading day of 2015. And on this day in 1890, President Benjamin Harrison welcomed Alice Sanger as the first female on the White House staff. Now go on and make each day count. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. For millions of workers around the country, the new year means a bigger paycheck. More than 20 states and the District of Columbia are raising their minimum wages this year, and in most places, that goes into effect today. Not talking about a huge hike in some places. In Florida, it's just a few cents an hour. But in others, take South Dakota, for instance, the minimum wage is going up by more than a dollar. We sent Marketplace's Amy Scott to talk to workers about what a little extra cash each week could mean for them.
Here in Maryland, minimum wage workers are getting a 75-cent raise today, from $7.25 an hour to $8. But in Baltimore this afternoon, McDonald's worker Kedra Jackson was unimpressed.
I really don't think it's going to make a difference. Still got bills to pay, and actually, a lot of employers are going to cut hours. I think so. Half of us, you know, are part-time already, so it's not going to make a difference.
It sounds like she's been talking to Jack Mosloom with the National Federation of Independent Business. He says some employers will make up for the extra cost by cutting jobs or reducing hours. Others just won't create new jobs.
The likely scenario won't be massive layoffs. It'll be a much quieter and broader effort on the part of local business owners to avoid hiring people.
Economists like Elise Gould, though, say far more workers will benefit than lose out. She's with the Economic Policy Institute, a liberal think tank. Gould says the extra money those workers earn will go right back into the economy.
Families at the bottom really need to spend their money. When they spend their money, it increases demand for goods and services, and that really stimulates the economy.
That effect will be modest in states like Florida, where the minimum wage rises by just 12 cents today. In Maryland, it's set to hit $10.10 an hour in 3 years, among the highest rates in the country. That could help workers like Ronald Watson. He makes just over $9.50 an hour at retail store Target.
That's groceries, you know, which is significant.
Efforts to raise the federal minimum wage to above $10 have stalled in Congress. But for the first time, as of today, more than half of states are now above the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
In recent years, federal spending on scientific research has not kept up with inflation. So some scientists have done what writers and musicians and filmmakers have done. They've turned to crowdfunding for support, which has raised some big questions. Reed Frazier, who's with the Pennsylvania public radio show The Allegheny Front, reports.
Susan Nagel studies the health impacts of chemicals used in fracking. Last year, Nagel of the University of Missouri found remnants of these chemicals in Colorado streams near where fracking spills had occurred.
So this was an initial study, and we found this kind of strong association.
But she wanted to go farther and confirm her results with more testing. Her grant application with the National Institutes of Health, however, sat in limbo for months.
And so we turned to crowdfunding.
Nagel set up a project page on the website experiment.com.
We spent a lot of time on the actual site, developing a video.
It's now time to do a comprehensive chemical analysis. However, this is costly, and we need your support. Please donate and share with your friends and family.
It worked. Nagel raised $25,000 for a follow-up study. Research like hers is the latest destination for online donors looking to back projects they like. Brian Meese of the crowdfunder Rocket Hub says science that strikes an emotional chord does better on his site.
Research for, you know, for animals, research for the environment, things that are curious, things that are quirky, things that are fun.
It helps if your page has awesome pictures of sharks or jaguars, or if it's about a topic donors care about. The crowd has launched hundreds of small-scale science projects, but some point to potential problems. When the federal government decides whether to fund a grant, panels of experts peer review each application. The National Science Foundation's Kevin Croston says it's not like that when the crowd is the judge.
You really need an expert to be able to look at that and say, well, you know, this really is new and interesting.
or, in fact, this is like something that's already been done.
Crowdfunders like Jai Ranganathan say they're working on it. Ranganathan runs SciFundChallenge.org, which vets projects to ensure the people behind them aren't, well, totally crazy.
Basically, they're just looking to screen out cranks, that you're not writing in crayon. And that's what we were trying to do.
Ranganathan says crowdfunding can fill in some gaps in federal funding. But in the end, it's no match for the biggest crowd of all, taxpayers. In Pittsburgh, I'm Reed Frazier for Marketplace.
Talk to a lot of small business owners who say they live and die by online reviews. How many stars they have, what comments say. I've seen signs next to cash registers encouraging customers to post reviews when they get home. I've seen managers weigh in when they think there's a review that's misleading or unfair. Online reviews vary in thoroughness, they vary in quality, and they can be unreliable. Mike Vichik is the creator of Wisely. It's an app that uses spending habits, not stars, to rate businesses. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to ask you first how Wisely works. If I were to go to the App Store and download the Wisely app, walk me through what happens next.
Sure. Basically, what happens is consumers link their credit cards to it, just like Mint.com or any of the other budgeting apps. But our focus is basically that we think how people spend tells a lot about what they like. What Wisely provides is personalized recommendations based on how you spend, like Netflix, but for the real world.
Does Wisely care about how I'm spending my money, where I'm spending my money, or is the company's concern more with how money's being spent at a particular business, at a restaurant, a bar, a place like that?
I would actually say both. There's been stats studied that say, you know, the difference of a half a star rating on Yelp can mean a 5 to a 9% swing in revenue potentially for businesses. There's also been studies that 80% plus of consumers use some sort of review-like service before they buy something. You know, you can write a review, and a lot of times we've seen on review services that those reviews are actually fake. They're positive, and they're, you know, done by the merchant and or their friends or people they paid. On the other hand, potentially a competitor can write a review that slams your business. So there's this tension that I think lots of people have noticed about review sites. What we're saying is that what really matters is how people have voted with their money. So if you have been to a place and lots of other people in an area have been there, that says the place is popular. And if a lot of those customers turn out to be repeat customers, that says people liked it enough to go again. And I think if you look at the repeat purchase behavior and you're able to kind of abstract that, it says a lot about the business, the bar or the restaurant or the coffee shop or the dry cleaner. But it also tells you from a personalization perspective, just the same way you see on Netflix or on Spotify, people like you also like these things.
So that first step is for me to forfeit my credit card information, my debit card information. That's a pretty big step, Mike.
Today, you know, I guess I would ask the question, how many times when you go out to dinner do you hand your credit card to a server who then takes it in the back room and could do whatever they wanted with it, copy down everything, and then they're out on Amazon like while they're back in the kitchen potentially buying things on your credit card. That's one option, right? Or that's one possible scenario. Another one is you go innocently shopping at a major retailer, and we've seen a number of breaches this year. So I think actually what we do is we actually bring your transactions to the forefront and make it easy for you to understand them and make it easier for you to keep track of them.
Is this app making money? Maybe you could talk to me a bit about how it might make money in the future.
We are not currently generating revenue. Our focus thus far has been on building an app that people love, right? And since we don't charge users, we don't yet make money. The way we envision doing that in the future is providing services to merchants. So, you know, so it's kind of a cool messaging platform to be able to communicate with people that care about your business as expressed by them being customers.
Mike Vichik is the co-founder and CEO of Wisely. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, David. Pleasure being with you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the website Business Insider flagged a report the Central Intelligence Agency released in the year 2000. 70 pages on what the world would look like in 2015. It's chock full of all kinds of predictions, many of which turned out to be true. The CIA wrote the world population will grow by more than 1 billion to 7.2 billion. That is right on the nose. Another prediction, Europe will not achieve fully the dreams of parity with the U.S. as a shaper of the global economic system. And man, was that prescient. The Eurozone faces slow growth and another recession. Of course, the CIA didn't get it all right in that report. It predicted the populations in many African countries would fall because of AIDS, famine, and continued economic and political turmoil. In fact, the continent's population has grown by about 300 million. You can find a link to that piece I mentioned at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace for this, the first day of January 2015. The major markets were closed for the New Year holiday. They'll reopen tomorrow. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm David Gura. We'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.